Are you ready? Are you ready?
Hello and welcome back to another episode of the 99%. I'm Mike McAndrew.
And I'm Lucien Wardaley.
Welcome back to another episode. This is episode 15. Welcome back to the show. Lucien, what has happened this week?
Way to put me on the spot, Michael. Very little has happened this week.
Yeah.
It's been a somewhat uneventful week in the areas of culture that we explore here on the show. But there was one big story this weekend.
There was.
Very sad story. The news of the death of the great Gene Wilder, a hero of mine, beloved by millions around the world, fantastic actor, comedian, all-around entertainer and performer. Of course, he's best known, he's known for a lot of things, known for working the producers, Blazing Saddles, his collaborations with the great Mel Brooks. But of course, he's known, you know, cross-generationally to many as the great, for his great performance in the 1971 film Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory.
Mm.
Everyone loves Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, don't they, Michael?
Sure do.
Just wonderful.
Yeah.
Gene Wilder, really fantastic in that film.
The light is showing, so the danger must be growing. Are the fires of hell aglowing? Is the grisly reaper mowing? Yes! The danger must be growing, for the rowers keep on rowing. And they're certainly not showing any signs that they are slowing!
Oh, make him stop, Daddy!
Wonka, does he go far enough? Quite right, sir. Stop the boat!
I think what Wilder demonstrates in this film is, you know, his enormous range as an actor, being sort of charming and likable and being absolutely terrifying and menacing in certain moments such as that. Of course, there's a great final scene of the film where Charlie and his uncle, or his grandfather, confront Wonka about the lifetime supply of chocolate that they've been promised, and Wonka offers a shockingly enraged response.
Mr. Wonka?
I am extraordinarily busy, sir.
I just wanted to ask about the chocolate. The lifetime supply of chocolate for Charlie. When does he get it?
He doesn't.
Why not?
Because he broke the rules.
What rules? We didn't see any rules, did we, Charlie?
Wrong, sir. Wrong. Under section 37B of the contract signed by him, it states quite clearly that all offers shall become null and void if, and you can read it for yourself in this photostatic copy, I, the undersigned, shall forfeit all rights, privileges, and licenses herein and herein contained, etc., etc., fax mentis incendium gloria culpum, etc., etc., memo bis punitor delicatum. It's all there, black and white, clear as crystal. You stole fizzy lifting drinks. You bumped into the ceiling, which now has to be washed and sterilized, so you get nothing. You lose. Good day, sir.
Another film that Gene Wilder worked on was Quackster Fortune Has a Cousin in the Bronx, an interesting little comedy that was shot in Dublin. And there's an extract from his autobiography where he tells kind of a interesting, pretty unique story about his time in Dublin. He says, "Children of the neighborhood gathered around us every day to watch his film. One little four-year-old boy was like the mascot of the group. Everyone protected him. He was dressed so nicely and scrubbed clean, and he always had a stoic face, except if one of us gave him an ice cream. Then he would smile slightly and say, 'Thanks very much.' I asked the director if we could use David in one of the scenes. It would mean money for his family. That afternoon, he was my sidekick in a very short scene. He just held my hand and I led him wherever I was supposed to go. The next day, I had a slightly bigger scene for him. We were sitting on the step in front of my house as I was trying to digest the fact that the horses had all been replaced. We had to do the scene several times. David didn't have any dialogue. He just had to sit quietly on my lap. After the fourth take, just as the camera started rolling, he said, 'I don't want to do this anymore.' A month later, David's mother started hinting in the nicest way that it might be nice if I adopted David and took him to America with me. David was one of eight children. His father was permanently disabled and the family survived on welfare. His mother wanted David to have a chance in life. I talked it over with Joe and Katie and they both said it was all right with them. I had the producer make some inquiries. The Irish government said yes, I could adopt David, but I would have to wait 2 years before I could take him out of the country. He would have to keep his own name and he would have to be raised as a Catholic. When I got over my anger with the Irish government, I took David for a picnic in the Wicklow Mountains, just the two of us, to find out if he would even want to come with me and live in America. After the most delicate probing, David said, "No, I don't want to do that." And that was that.
That was that.
So an interesting story there about Gene Wilder and his time in Ireland. Seemed just like such a genuine, such a warm soul in every way. Really, really great guy. So Gene Wilder there, who died this week at the age of 83. So a little earlier on, we spoke to Rusty Goff, who played one of the original Oompa Loompas in Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, acting opposite Gene Wilder. Rusty's had a really great career. He also appeared in the original Star Wars and in some of the Harry Potter films. And we talked to him about his work with Gene Wilder and his career in general. So, Rusty, you've made a lot of films during your career. Does Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory stand out in your memory as a special experience?
Yes, Willy Wonka was my first ever movie.
Wow.
And I was very new at it, but with Gene Wilder, he was an absolutely fantastic guy. He was a gentleman. And there's nothing big, no big star ego about him. He was a lovely guy, and he helped a lot of people on that set. With the five kids, and some were there, because we filmed it in Munich, in Germany, with the five kids. Some didn't have their parents there at all. And he acted like a stepfather, read them stories, kept them entertained, you know, so they wouldn't get bored or miss home, you know. He was fantastic.
Was his real-life persona very similar to the Wonka persona that we saw in the film?
Yeah, he was quieter, but, you know, that mischievous glint in his eye. You know, he's a very, very funny man. Yeah, he was a nice guy. Yeah, we never saw him get angry at all.
Wow.
Except on the set. Yeah, too.
Did you get to spend a lot of time one-on-one with him when you were shooting your scenes?
Yes, we did. Yeah, because when we weren't working, because we did have a few problems, like when the a waterfall, and that got all clogged up with the real sugar and cream we were pouring into it. They had to drain all the water out, the river out, completely drain it, clean the pumps of the waterfall, and then they had to refill it with water. But when we're talking about, you know, 46 years ago, there's no computers, no anything like that. So what they had to do was fill it with water, put a bit of dye in it, start the waterfall, mix it around, film it, develop it, have a look at it, add a bit more dye. And that process went on for 2 weeks.
Wow.
We had a lot of time, you know, chatting to people like Gene and Roy Kinnear and everyone. You know, we were all one big, fat, happy family.
Brilliant. How did you go about getting the role of an Oompa Loompa? Did they approach you or did you audition?
No, they approached me because there was, at that time, in the 70s, there was only four guys and one girl, short people, actors, in this country. So we were, like, doing pantomimes and things like that. You think pantomime Snow White, yes, they used two children to end up the other seven. Mm-hmm. So there were only five actors in this country. So they got the other five guys from all over Europe. One guy was from Germany. He lived in Munich, so they didn't pay him much. Then they were one guy from Malta, one guy from Turkey, France, etc. So, but the language barrier was very different in those days.
How did you find the Oompa Loompa costume and the makeup? Did you have any influence over the design? Or
the costume was absolutely okay. Yeah. The white trousers, the brown and white stockings, and the shoes, yeah, like ballet pumps, and the jersey here pretty beautifully. But the one problem was there with the makeup, the wig, the green wig. They thought that every dwarf has got the same size head. Mm. No. We're all different, like you, Michael, everybody else. We've got different shaped heads. So, but they had 10 wigs made exactly the same. It was like pull it on, stretch it, nail it, glue it on, to get it fitted, you know, fitted on. So that was quite painful, like the headaches started coming within 10 minutes. And when you're on the set for about 12 hours, it was a bit much.
And how was the shooting and rehearsing the musical numbers? Did you rehearse for a long time for those?
Yes, we did. We had a rehearsal with Howard Jeffrey, the choreographer, and he sat down. We sat down, and he went flitting around like Rudolf Nureyev, you know, like a big ballet dancer. And we said, well done, Howard, excellent. He said, right, we'll start the first move. So you expect us to do that? Yeah, you're trained dancers. He was told we were trained dancers. But no, So we, back to basics, lift one leg up, kick it out, and put it down again. Funny.
Yeah. The film has a really timeless appeal where grandparents, parents, children, they all really love it equally. Why do you think it has such a broad appeal?
Because it was made for adults. Yeah, it was made for adults, not children. Made for adults. So, yeah, it's got this great appeal. You know, people still ask me, hey, what was you guys on in the late 60s there, 70s, early 70s, with that boat ride? You know, what were you on? Yeah. Which was quite, you know, very psychedelic in the late 60s, which it was.
So, you've also appeared in the original Star Wars quite a few years later. Could you tell us maybe how... If you thought that it was going to be successful when you were working on it?
No one knew what Star Wars, even George and Gary Kurtz, the producer. Yeah. I don't think they knew how big it was going to be. We didn't, you know, because everything was done on the cheap. You know, Sir Alec Guinness, he was on the percentage. Everyone was on peanuts. And for some of the costumes, from the Gonk Droid costume, I was just wearing an upside down polystyrene water cistern, and the bits stuck on the front was like they were kicking around the car park looking for bits of plastic to stick on it and spray it grey, black, whatever. And there we are. We had a costume on the legs. It was like corrugated piping from air conditioning, and they made some shoes out of cardboard. There we are. How cheap can you get?
So, can you tell us maybe a bit about the work that you've done since? And do you kind of plan to continue acting in the future?
No, I've retired about 2 years ago. The government over here, they keep sending me money every 4 weeks. It's very nice. They call it a pension, and I don't even have to get off my backside to get it. It goes into my bank. It's very nice. I like it. The first week it arrived, I thought, oh, this is nice. Then the telephone rang, and this voice said, hello, good afternoon, this is the BBC. Would you like to do an episode of Doctor Who?
Oh, I went, yes. Wow.
He said, well, you thought about it. Yes, because you know, all through the career of any actor, you have to do an episode of Doctor Who. And I've always wanted to do one, and it happened a week after I said I was going to retire. So I came out of retirement after a week. And then there's an episode with Peter Capaldi called The Robots of Sherwood.
Wow.
That was good. Yeah. And that's the last thing I've done.
Yeah.
Well, apart from going around conventions, which I absolutely love, meeting the fans, etc.
Yeah, sure. Mm. Yes. Well, Rusty, thank you so much for talking to us.
It's no problem. It's great to speak to you. Have a good life and be safe.
Thank you. And we continue to enjoy your work all the time.
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
Really terrific.
Thanks, Rusty.
Thank you very much. So thanks again to Rusty Goff for speaking to us. And that was, of course, in tribute to Gene Wilder, who died this week at the age of 83. Michael, what was Jill Stein tweeting about this week?
Jill Stein was tweeting about Harambee.
We all
or Harambee.
Harambee. So Harambee has, of course, caught the attention of the world since he was so cruelly murdered back in May in Cincinnati Zoo. And he is now being used as a political tool by the American establishment.
Well, some people would say it was cruelty. Other people would say it was a necessity.
What would you say, Michael, to put you on the spot?
I honestly can't. I don't know
would
enough
you,
about
would
this
you have shot Harambee?
Dude, that's a tough question to ask me.
I know. 99% is all about tough questions.
Well, I don't know enough, okay? Apparently, so the case was made that if they tranquilized Harambee, he would go crazy.
Yeah.
Before the tranquilizer kicked in.
Okay. But
potentially putting the child at risk.
Yeah.
Whereas shooting Harambe seemed less risky to the life of the child. Okay?
Yeah.
And it's an incredibly tough moral situation. Do you put the life of the animal first or the life of the child first? And that was a call that had to be made. And I don't blame anybody for making the decision that had, because they had to make a decision.
Yeah.
I don't blame anybody for making the decision that they made.
Okay.
Right? That's my personal view.
That's fine.
So I don't,
okay.
That answers your question.
So Jill Stein tweeted, what was her tweet? It was Harambe, the murder of Harambe reminds us to, we need to listen to the voiceless. Something like this. She's, of course, the Green Party presidential candidate.
Yeah, yes.
In the US election. I think this was her attempt to appeal to a younger social media Harambe obsessed demographic that maybe otherwise she is not gaining much momentum
with. So, like, since the death of Harambe, there have been memes galore of just people.
The internet has mourned him on a daily basis.
Mourned him seriously and also incredibly mockingly.
Yes.
Most people take to the internet to mock the people who are so seriously mourning the death of Harambe.
Well, also the entire internet mourning of Harambe is in itself a parody of the sort of culture of mourning that 2016 media has been very much, because of how many people have been mourned this year, that the media has taken on this state of perpetual mourning, from Bowie to Prince to Gene Wilder, and the whole Harambe situation is sort of an exaggerated showcase of this mood. That's one way of looking at it.
Yeah, it is.
We should point out the reason we're talking about Jill Stein and Harambe is because, as we noted in the doc, geez, Trump and Hillary sure didn't do much this way.
Yeah, I mean, Trump. There's no news about Trump. No news about Hillary this week. So Jill Stein has taken the lead on this. So she released a statement anyway about the killing of Harambe instance.
3 months after it happened.
3 months after it happened. Although, didn't it says June 1st on the statement.
Well, it was the end of it. It was very late May, so. Oh, wait, her statement's from June 1st.
Her statement must be
from June 1st. They must have just dug it up because she tweeted it.
They just dug it up. Oh, yeah, okay, dug up the statement. But yeah, no, she did tweet about this, yeah. So, there you go.
All right. Well, the biggest news of the week was back here at home. And this was this was a big story in the US and in Europe and in Britain.
Oh, yeah.
And this is to do with Apple Incorporated.
Yeah, and it's an incredibly complex situation. Basically, the 3 years ago, the EU Commission launched an investigation into Apple. And the reason why was because it seemed like Apple set up a headquarters in Ireland in which they funneled nearly all of the European revenue through. Quite a lot of their revenue in other countries outside the EU through as well. And the problem with that is that other countries that Apple are based in do not receive any money from Apple in the form of tax. Ireland has been known for, since joining the EU, to be used as a tax haven for multinationals. And so we have the lowest corporate tax rate in Europe at 12.5%. But the reality is that although, I mean, okay, so the UK is at what, 14%? Like Germany's, France's, their corporation tax is higher. But the reality is that with tax incentives and the likes, most companies who are based in other European countries don't pay what the advertised corporation tax rate is.
Yeah.
Now, there, the investigation was launched because the EU Commission believed that there was illegal activity going on.
Mm-hmm.
The investigation, interestingly, was launched into Apple and not the Irish government, which strikes me as somewhat strange. Mm-hmm. It's something that the media hasn't really focused on that much. But basically, what they found was that in 2014, Apple paid 0.0005% tax to the Irish government. From 2003, they paid less than 1% tax to the Irish government. And the EU Commission claimed that this is illegal.
Mm-hmm.
There are EU laws put in place that say that this is illegal.
Yeah.
So there are, what makes this so complex is that there are so many different variables and so many different issues that are beneath the surface that we don't see.
Mm-hmm.
But essentially, what the result of this investigation was is that the EU are asking Apple to pay 13 billion euro to the Irish government, to the Irish state, plus interest,
mm-hmm.
which will be probably another several billion dollar or billion euro.
Yeah.
So on the surface, it appears many people would see that and they go, this is a victory, right?
Mm-hmm.
The Irish state gets 13 billion euro. It doesn't seem like there's a risk of Apple ever moving out of Ireland. And that's the reason why the Irish government gave tax breaks in the first place was to, if Apple comes knocking on your door as a small country and they say, hi, we would like to set up our European, our EU headquarters.
You give them whatever
here,
they want.
You give them whatever you want. This is a country that netted $600 billion last year.
Mm.
So that was, I guess that was the approach that the EU Commission took was in investigating Apple.
Yeah.
So it appears at the, you know, on the surface as if it's a victory because Ireland are now getting 13 billion euro.
Mm-hmm.
That is basically equal to our entire health budget last year. About 66%, I think, 66-67% of our social welfare budget.
I mean, with that money, we could house everybody on the housing waiting list in the country, pretty much.
You could build 20 new hospitals if you wanted to. So that really...
that's from one company operating in Ireland.
One company. Yeah. Now, it's also has to be stated that most companies, and this is where the problem is, this is what makes it illegal, is if every company was paying less than 1% corporation tax, there wouldn't be as much of an issue.
Yeah.
But it's the unfair treatment of a single company.
Mm-hmm.
Every other company really pays 12.5%.
Yeah, yeah.
They get R&D tax credits and tax incentives and all that, but that's fine because everybody's entitled to that.
Mm-hmm.
It's when you get special treatment that questions start to arise.
Yeah.
And the EU Commission are now going after Google also. I think they want to go after a number of other multinational companies. So the question stands now. Do the Irish government take the 13 billion euro?
Because they don't want to.
Correct. Correct. And that's what
they are rejecting free money. That is owed to them. That is rightfully theirs, based on pre-existing and very reasonable tax rates.
And in order to understand this story the best, I think what you have to do is throw all rationale out the window.
Yeah, yeah.
Because there's no rational thinking behind this, okay?
Yeah.
Like, there's so many different variables. There's pressure being put in so many different places. Mm. So, essentially, Michael Noonan came out with a statement, and he said, we're going to appeal this.
Yeah.
Along with Apple, we support Apple in this.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to appeal it. We don't we don't agree with the EU Commission's the results of their investigation. And we believe that Apple owes us nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Apple have also released a statement saying we are kind of in a strange situation right now, mm-hmm. because we are being asked to pay 13 billion mm-hmm. euro to a country that doesn't want
yeah.
it. There are many people in Ireland who would love the government to take the money.
Yeah.
There are also a lot of people who wouldn't.
Mm-hmm.
But we have to...
But the people who wouldn't, it's based more on thinking into the future, thinking what the impact of Apple
exactly.
suddenly experiencing a huge disadvantage in Ireland from their perspective
sure.
would be.
Yeah, and
it's not
it
that those people don't want 13 billion in the Irish government budget. That would be fantastic. The point is that those people think that the negative, the downfall for Ireland
mm-hmm.
at a later stage of Apple suddenly having to pay us the rate that they should be would be isn't worth getting this money.
There's two issues. There's the reputational effect
yeah.
and the economic effect.
Yeah.
So the reputational effect, which Michael Noonan did talk about in his release, press release, was that, well, if the EU Commission can easily grant this, what we have done with our tax system,
mm-hmm.
if they can grant that illegal, do we have any control over our tax system mm-hmm. at all?
Yeah, yeah.
Which that seems is an issue, right? Mm. So at the point, it's what he's saying is that the government should take a stance against this because we need to
protect our sovereignty,
protect our sovereignty
and our government's decisions,
freedom to make decisions.
Yeah, yeah.
As poor as they may
seem, as questionable as they may seem.
So then there's the economic impact,
mm-hmm.
which seems initially, at least, very minor, if any,
yeah.
impact. And that is because Apple aren't really in a position to move now.
Yeah.
But what it means is that in the future, Apple will have to pay a lot more tax. And
yeah.
what does that mean for Apple's future here? And so I can only presume that the government at the time when they were making the decision as to whether to bring Apple in with a vastly reduced tax rate
mm-hmm.
or to let them go to another country, that they thought, well, okay, if we reduce our tax rate, what happens? We get huge number of jobs, huge number of we get a huge increase in our employment levels,
mm-hmm.
which looks great for us.
Yeah.
And then Apple, I'm sure, will pay their employees very well.
Mm-hmm.
So you'll have a number of taxpayers in the higher tax bracket, and that tax will actually, like 80% of it, will probably come back to us anyway.
Yeah,
right. They don't really care the fact that where the tax is coming from, where the money is coming from. But the reality is you'll still get most of the money back anyway.
Mm.
And so, yeah, that does seem logical to a certain extent. So, whereas now, if they do take the 13 billion, what happens?
Mm.
Initially, there's no impact. But in the future, Apple can so easily just move.
Yeah.
Right. And what impact would that have on the Irish economy?
Mm.
We don't. Well,
yeah.
It's so hard to tell, right?
And the population is very split on this.
And the population is
very split. If you listen to Joe Duffy, like, it's half and half.
Yeah, and that's because it's such
it's interesting.
So then you have the EU's point of view.
Mm.
The US, like, Obama has literally gone out and said, the EU are screwing us over.
Mm.
And that's because Apple are an American company.
Yeah.
And so the US feel like
the money is theirs.
The money is theirs, which to a certain degree, yeah.
It can be argued. But at the same time, they're using our land, and if they don't want to pay tax here,
yeah.
Get out.
So It's such a difficult situation. So, from one perspective, it appears like we've been handed something. We've been handed 13 billion euro.
Mm.
Why wouldn't you take it?
Yeah.
Right? This can change the country.
Mm. And also, it's not like the 12.5% is unreasonable. It's very, it's comparatively very low corporation tax rate for, a European country of our, on our level. Like, so
it is.
It's not as if we're charging them an unreasonable amount of tax.
On paper, we're charging them the most reasonable rate.
Yeah.
But, you know, what we do with incentives, every other country does too. So there's a lot, and that's what makes it so complex. And then there's the whole argument of the EU bullying us.
Yeah.
Because we're such a small country.
Mm-hmm.
We have absolutely no power.
Yeah.
So what do you do? Do you fight the EU on this?
Mm.
I mean, how do you fight them?
Yeah.
Okay, you have Apple on your side, but it's the EU.
You kind of have America on your side.
You have, well, you kind of do. But you know America.
America has better things to be doing.
America just want to use the situation to just state their opinion on it.
Yeah. They don't actually care.
They don't actually care.
They're not going to put a lot of effort into it.
No. But you have to remember that Ireland is still a member of the EU, and we gain so much from being part of the EU.
And I am very, very happy that we're in the EU.
So, you know, I've had this conversation.
We don't want air exits.
Exactly. I've had this conversation with so many people, and the only conclusion I can come to is that there is no conclusion. I literally can't figure out what the best way to do. And this is a tough decision for the government. If you look at the situation that the government are being put in, it looks like all of the Fine Gael members of the cabinet are aligned on this.
Yeah.
That they're going to appeal.
Mm-hmm.
They're taking Michael Noonan's side.
Mm-hmm.
However, the independents, their opinion is unclear at this moment.
Yeah.
I think they're meeting today,
mm-hmm.
so I guess we'll find out. You'll have already found out after this episode goes out.
Yeah.
What their stance is. But if they do not agree, if members of the cabinet don't agree, that's going to put our minority government into question.
That brings us to a regular part of the show where I ask Michael a very important question. As it stands, Michael, has the Fine Gael minority government collapsed yet?
No.
Okay. Moving on now, it is time for...
It's time for the 99 second quiz, Lou.
You're asking the questions this week.
I'm asking the questions this week. We brought it back after a week of no 99 second quiz.
We need that quiz in our lives.
So I put together a nice quiz for you today, Lou, to test. This is a pretty tricky quiz. I'm not going to expect you to do well on it, just to be honest. Okay. Let me get the timer out. Let's do this thing. Ready for this?
Quiz. I'm ready.
All right, the timer starts now. The CAO offered more than 80,000 college places last week. But for which of these courses did the points rise? Medicine, construction, or IT?
Construction.
Robbie Keane has retired from international soccer last week, following an 18-year career representing his country. What team did he play against in his official last game?
Something really strange. A pass.
Colombian rebels have signed an agreement that ends a civil war that lasted how long?
35 years.
Who remains the youngest person to win an acting Oscar?
The youngest person.
Tatum O'Neill?
Damn. The actor known by the stage name Gene Wilder died this week. Age 83.
What was his real name?
What was his real name? Nolan.
It's not in here.
Okay.
Wait.
No, you can't do this.
No, I don't know. I don't know. Wilderman something. I don't know.
Which American actor, musician, and comedian's 47th birthday was celebrated this weekend?
47. I don't know. Bradley Cooper? I don't know.
Whose song, Ride, is number one on the top Billboard Top 100 this week?
Ride or Rise?
Ride.
Never heard of it.
We are done. All right.
Did I get one?
Yes, you did.
Excellent.
Which so, one?
Tatum O'Neill.
Okay. Yeah. You got Tatum O'Neill. That was impressive.
That's an excellent.
For what film?
Paper Moon. It's a great film.
That's amazing.
It's her and her dad, Ryan O'Neill, and they're on a tour kind
that's
of
impressive.
Scouting
I have
people.
To say, I didn't think you were going to get that
it's
one.
Great film.
So yeah, the CAO offered more than 80,000. You got that correct.
Oh, I did.
Construction.
Oh, got two. Okay.
Robbie Keane, his last game was against Oman.
Oh, yes. I genuinely would have never got that.
Colombian Rebels, the Civil War, 52 years.
All right.
Yeah, the Tatum O'Neill. Gene Wilder's real name is Jerome Silberman. Jack Black's Jack Black's birthday?
47.
Ride is a 21 Pilots song. Yeah. and yeah, that's it.
All
impressive.
Right.
I have to say.
Two.
You got
two.
You got two. But that's impressive because that was a really tricky.
It was pretty hard.
Yeah, it was pretty tricky.
What's this week's classic album, Michael?
This week's classic album is one of, I think, every one of our parents our age favorite albums. Brothers in Arms by Dire Straits. Quality album.
Quality.
Most famous probably for its last track on the album,
which is
Brothers in
Arms.
Yes,
the title track. I'm very familiar with this.
Also well known for the MTV hit Money for Nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, let's play Brothers in Arms now.
This intro goes on a very long time. Whoa. This intro goes on quite a while.
Sure does. Let's skip it.
Brilliant use of this song in the West Wing episode, Two Cathedrals.
Fun fact of the day.
Any West Wing fans will have a deep appreciation for the song.
These mist-covered mountains are home now for me, but my home is the lowlands and always will be.
And so that is Brothers in Arms.
It's a response to the Vietnam War, isn't it?
I believe so, yeah.
Very good song.
It's an incredibly, incredibly great song. But of course, Money for Nothing, another classic that has an equally long intro. This album really loves equally long intros. Sting is featured on this.
Oh.
Going, I want my MTV.
Oh, yes, of course.
Yeah. Like that Sting there, I believe, at the beginning.
Sounds like him.
Yeah.
Nothing beats a bit of Sting.
It's very true. Very 80s there. We'll be right back. That is money for nothing.
Very nice.
Yeah, so Brothers in Arms is like everybody's favorite Dire Straits album, except for mine.
What's your favorite Dire Straits album?
The first Dire Straits album.
What's it called? Dire Straits?
It's called Dire Straits. Okay. And it's... Yeah, I think it's more of quintessential what Dire Straits is, you know. Brothers in Arms is heavily influenced by 80s synth stuff, heavily influenced by more... It's more of pop culture... kind of base, you know, whereas Dire Straits is more about, you can hear more of Mark Knopfler's folk influences in it. It's an album that I enjoy more. And there's more kind of song, more iconic songs me on the first album. But this is the one that everybody loves, like, because it's 85 it came out, so you know that's like an MTV, the rise of MTV and all that stuff.
It was
so
very part it of was, the zeitgeist.
Yeah, it's part of 80s culture, like. So that is Brothers in Arms, classic album of this week,
and that is available on
Spotify
and iTunes.
Time now for
Spacey Film of the Week.
Yeah.
So, 2 weeks ago, our Kevin Spacey Film of the Week was Nine Lives, a film about Kevin Spacey playing a talking cat. So this Monday, I was sitting at home. It was a rainy day outside. Not much to do. Saw that Nine Lives was playing in the local cinema.
Oh, no.
So I went to see it.
Oh, how could you do that?
Shane Kelly, our 99% world correspondent.
Went with you.
Attended with
I
me.
Did not.
Not come. Probably better for the best. No, we saw Nine Lives. It's without a doubt the worst Kevin Spacey film of the week that we've done on the show.
To date.
To date. But that said, it's not a terrible film. It's just very... it's just very nothing. It's extremely short, extremely quiet. The music, the score is all elevator music. It's a very, very inoffensive, unabrasive, quiet, weird, forgettable film.
But it's not terrible.
It's not terrible. It didn't enrage me in any way. It was a way to spend 80 minutes on a Monday afternoon. Not a particularly enjoyable one. It wasn't very funny, but Christopher Walken engaging with a cat voiced by Kevin Spacey. I must say, the cat in the film doesn't talk. It's not a talking cat.
It's just
an internal monologue that we're hearing.
Right.
The cat never opens its
mouth. But isn't that is the point? Because
Kevin Spacey swaps bodies with the cat. So he's trapped inside the cat. Now, there is a pretty amusing scene where the cat, because it's just Kevin Spacey inside the cat, raids the liquor cabinet and steals a bottle of scotch, drinks the entire thing, and then the cat stumbles around drunk.
What happens? So the cat becomes Kevin Spacey?
So Kevin Spacey becomes the cat while Kevin Spacey's body is in the hospital in a coma.
Ah, I get you.
Yeah.
But isn't Kevin Spacey talking is just what Christopher Walken's character can hear, though, right? The rest of the world...
Christopher Walken's the only person who can talk to the cat.
Who can talk to the cat.
He's the cat whisperer.
Yeah, the cat whisperer.
It feels very dated. It's the script, I would imagine, was written about 20 years ago, because there's jokes in it about George W. Bush that are just so out of date. He could easily have replaced his name with Donald Trump, and it would have worked as easily.
Yeah, yeah.
It would have worked a lot better. But, I mean, it's a children's film. It's got an extended joke about scotch and George W. Bush and... I just don't know who it's aiming for. Most of the crew that comes up in the credits at the end are French. I mean, it was distributed by Luc Besson's Europa, and it just seems like a French film that had some American actors shoehorned in, because it's the kind of film that the French make a lot of and go to see a lot. They're kind of mainstream broad comedy. But, you know, I've seen worse. Anyway, this week's Kevin Spacey film of the week
is not Nine Lives, because you've already done that.
Margin Call. Ooh. This is directed by J.C. Chandor. Is that Chandor? J.C. Chandor.
Yeah.
Great director. He made he's made 3 films, and they're all really, really good. Margin Call, then he made All Is Lost with Robert Redford, and he made A Most Violent Year with Oscar Isaac. So Margin Call is a financial drama.
I haven't seen the whole film, but I've seen a good few parts
great
of it.
Great cast. Yeah. Zachary Quinto, Kevin Spacey, Demi Moore, Jeremy Irons, Stanley Tucci, a few others, Paul Bettany. Really good film. So it basically is about a group of, you know, financial analysts working in a, wherever they're working, investment firm or whatever. And it's basically set over the course of one night as they try to deal with an impending economic catastrophe. And really, really great writing, great performances all around. Kevin Spacey has, he's not the main character, but he has a pretty good, you know, small but... as in so many Kevin Spacey films, a small but very memorable role in the film. It's called Margin Call. It's on TV a lot, but you can always get it on DVD, and I would recommend that you check it out. Very, very enjoyable, very, very engaging film.
Awesome.
The best Aaron Sorkin film that Aaron Sorkin didn't write. And to wrap up today's show...
bit of low-stakes cereal.
You have a low-stakes cereal, don't you, Michael?
Yeah, it's... well...
the stakes aren't so low.
The stakes aren't so low. Are you aware of Oberstown?
The name is familiar to me.
It's a youth detention center in Oberstown. It's basically where it's like a prison for juvenile
facility.
It's a juvenile delinquent facility. But something really weird happened. The staff from Oberstown went on a strike. And as a result, they locked all of the residents in their cells.
Okay.
And so there was a group of five of these residents who didn't quite like that, that they were suffering just because the staff decided to go on a protest. So they basically put the place up on fire. The fire brigade was called. The roof collapsed. But they put the fire out. And so, they're apparently it's still fit for purpose, according to Minister Catherine Zappone now. But kind of raises a few questions about what's going on there and the staff and the way that residents are being treated.
Or even the way the staff are being treated.
Or even the way that the staff are being treated.
What their motivation was for going on strike.
And what their motivation... yeah, exactly. So, of course, we're going to follow this story.
As we do with all our other low-stakes cereal.
And report back in the future if we hear updates about it. But it seems quite serious.
Mm-hmm.
And it's never good... how could residents even be able to light a fire? Start a fire. I mean, I'd struggle to start a fire anywhere.
Yeah.
but that's just me.
Yeah.
Hopefully the staff can resolve whatever issues they're protesting about and that the situation is properly managed.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's pretty much it for today's edition of the 99%.
Yes, it is.
Thank you again to Rusty for joining us earlier today.
It's great.
To talk about Gene Wilder and about his career. We'll be back next week with more 99%. You can follow Michael on Twitter, MacAndrewTweets. I am Revolutionary. Visit facebook.com/99pshow, twitter.com/99pshow, instagram.com/99pshow, and 99pshow.com. We hope you've enjoyed this episode.
Yeah, we'll see you next week, guys. Enjoy.
Have a nice week. Yeah.